continuing with Bruce Lee on 1 March 1978. So apparently you were referring to the Hay, Parsons, and Phillips 1946, where they suggested that it was intrinsically the source.
Yes, I'm fairly certain that that would have been the case. I think that was about the only information we had at that time.
Well, there's another interesting point here, though, is that you point out that Cygnus A, and you had an upper limit for it at that time of 1.5 arc minutes in size, twinkled because it was small, just like the stars twinkle, and that some of the other sources, which were extended, were analogous to the planets. And I think that was the first time that people had pointed out that that might be one reason for the variation in the scintillation indices, as we say now, of different sources.
Yes, that must have been, I think, a fairly novel idea at the time.
Were you working at all on this theory of the ionosphere, or was that once again mainly John Bolton?
I did most of the record analysis and so on for the ionospheric work, mm-hmm. which was published in a separate paper rather later, I think.
That's right, that's right.
All the statistical work and correlations and so on, most of that was done by...
That was Bolton, Stanley, and Slee, 53. Slee and Stanley, 53.
Yes.
1947 to 51, low altitude scintillations,
yes.
The four radio sources.
Mm.
And, well, just to finish this topic off, what did you find in that paper? What were the main results?
Well, we found that scintillation behavior of the sources could be interpreted in terms of irregularities in the electron density in the ionosphere. Mainly, the main correlation we found was between sporadic E and mm-hmm. Scintillations. Although there could have been some correlation with spread F for the peak which we obtained at midnight. We had two peaks in the apparent distribution, one at midday and one at midnight. This could be interpreted either as a seasonal effect because
right.
the source changed its time of rising through the year, 24 hours through the year, or in terms of a diurnal effect. We had no evidence either way.
Yeah. But I gather that then that you, by this time, were becoming an ionospheric physicist, essentially. You're quite familiar with the literature. And,
yes, I was fairly familiar with the literature at the time.
And let's see, what else? You find that the scintillation index was larger at the lower frequencies and at the lower altitudes, as one might expect.
Yes.
Now, I'm not all that familiar with the ionospheric physics side of things. These were new results to the ionospheric physicists? Or were they mainly of interest to the radio astronomers trying to get rid of these effects?
Well, I think they were essentially... as soon as we published the results, of course, the ionospheric physicists pointed out that they could have... Some of their own results could be interpreted in terms of this... small scale irregularities in the ionosphere, the scattering and the fading which they got on space perceivers
mm-hmm.
could be interpreted in terms of similar sized blobs in the ionosphere. But it was not until we had discovered this effect that such small scale blobs were known with certainty.
I see. So that was mainly, perhaps the main result from an ionosphere point of view.
Yes. Mm.
Okay, well, let's take a break and we'll resume. So in 53, you and Bolton published what is fair to call, I think, the definitive paper on the theory of the C interferometer. And perhaps you could tell me what you see as the main advantages of the C interferometer and the main disadvantages relative to the Michelson interferometer, which, of course, was being used at Cambridge at that time.
Well, one of the main advantages of the C interferometer is... comes from the fact that you only need one aerial rather than two. You get the reflection in the sea as the additional element. It has another advantage in the fact that sources rise rapidly. You might have a strong source below the horizon and a weak one preceding it. You get the weak one, then the strong one.
Right, so it's an occultation phenomenon,
yes.
Really. Yes.
So that you're able to take weaker sources in the presence of stronger sources.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if they precede the stronger source,
right.
Not otherwise.
If you're looking at rising anyway, as you were, right. If you could look both ways, then of course
it's a very cheap way of getting phase stability and reasonable resolution. collective and no long connected cables.
Mm-hmm.
You only need one receiver. You don't need preamplifiers, aerials and so on. Its main disadvantage is, of course, the low frequencies is the ionosphere, and atmospheric refraction, of course, can be severe too. Ducting in the atmosphere can rather wreck the observations.
What about the fact that you can't vary the baseline? Did you find that much of a drawback?
Well, given frequency, of course, you can't vary the baseline, but if you assume that the source structure remains the same, you can...
Well, that's a big assumption, that one.
That's a very big assumption, yes. It's rather difficult to vary the baseline and go and cap the area around the country, different cliffs, and that's very inconvenient.
But you did do some of that, didn't you?
Yes, that was done in the early days, trips to New Zealand, and much of the Cygnus and Cygnus A work, and the Crab Nebula, Virgo, and Centaurus was done on cliffs in New Zealand.
For this mobile work, so to speak, were you using surplus radars that were designed for mobile, or did you sort of make up a trailer?
Just it? Made up a trailer with 3 or 4 Yagi aerials, which could be stepped on the top and towed by a truck,
mm-hmm.
receivers inside, and chart recorders. That was it.
And you just got your position from a map as to where each location was? Or
oh, yes, a survey map was usually put in for this minute of our kind of resolution.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask about the technique from the beginning. What was its origin, really? Was it something that had been used as a radar technique in shipboard radars, or...?
What they see it from?
Yes.
Well, it came from the Lloyd mirror experiment in optics, really.
Right, but this is a long ways to go from that to an antenna on top of a cliff.
And of course, it was known from radar work during the war that you got good reflection off sea and you form a low pattern. And this is really a basis of identifying the height of an aircraft flying into a radar beam as it passed through the successive lobes of the radar.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, it was fairly obvious that it should work at the source work, I think. And except that nobody up to that time had done it.
Right.
They tried.
Right. So it was a direct, is it fair to say it was a direct outcome of the military radar experience?
Yes, yeah, so of course they used it on the sun, Dover Heights. It was the first experiment
mm-hmm.
on the active sun by Pausing and McCready.
Right. Had these effects of refraction and so forth been worked out for the military application also? Were there sort of standard tables, maybe not as accurate as you needed?
I don't think, I think they have been worked out, but not as accurately as we needed the refraction corrections.
Mm-hmm.
The effect was, of course, anticipated.
What would you say was, well, first of all, when were the last Seacliff measurements made? About what year?
Dover Heights, I think they were made about 1954 or 5, I'd say.
That was producing this catalog of 100.
Yes.
And
was that published about 1955? I
think. Can't quite find it here now. Where are we? 54. 104 radio sources.
Yes, well, it must have been early in 54 that we stopped the sea interferometry.
And
from then on, we were concerned with that 80-foot dish, which...
So, at that point, the Seacliff interferometer was retired, so to speak.
Yes.
And I guess you figured that flexibility just didn't have enough to continue...
That's true, yes.
Exploiting that technique any further.
At the time, Mills Cross was in the offing at Fleurs, and they'd done the initial design and work on it, and it would seem to be the instrument to take over any future survey work.
Mm-hmm. On the other hand, Bolton
think,
was...
Rabo was, at that time, on the Pacific Islands, doing some very high-resolution sea interferometry. I think he had a base at Hawaii.
Oh, yes.
Honolulu or something.
it was on Haleakala.
Yes, that's right.
Reaver, he never got much out of that.
No, I think the atmospheric effects just ruined him.
But you're right, he was one of the person that tried to see in a barometer. Just for my information, Bolton, however, of course, did not work in that group, so he wanted to continue with radio. So, that's when he went into rain physics, isn't it?
That's right. Yeah.
That's right. Okay, that explains that. Anything else about the sea interferometer that that I should know?
I don't really think there's anything important that we've missed about the sea interferometer.
You had to understand how the reflection coefficient changed with the sea state, of course, also, right?
Well, I don't know that we knew too much about that. The effects of the waves on the...
Right.
But the reflection coefficient is obvious on that record. But,
Is that something you just sort of live with? You,
I think at the first few lobes, this reflection coefficient is not really affected. This is what we normally use, the first dozen or so.
I see.
Fringes as the source rays.
Mm-hmm.
So that you can deduce the source size and so on from the ratio of the fringe intensity to the total intensity from that. But otherwise, I don't think we really considered the reflection coefficient in any quantitative way.
The change in height due to tides also had to be considered, is that not correct?
Yes, that was in there, that was considered in the highly accurate source work in the New Zealand observations.
Did you just take standard tide tables, or did you have actually something that measured the height?
I think they had to just take the standard tide table, the standard tables, and use those. I found that would be accurate enough.
So, let's talk about this survey that must have gone on for 2 or 3 years, in which you ended up with 104 radio sources at 100 megahertz. Was this indeed covered the declination range plus 50 to minus 50?
Yes.
So I guess you methodically covered this entire range.
Yes, that's true. We used the aerial on the cliff, a 9-yardy aerial, which was we set up especially on the cliff edge for that. And we just turned the aerial around gradually from the north to the south.
That 17-foot dish that I was showing you the slide of, that was used only at higher frequencies than 100 megahertz? What was the lowest frequency that it was used?
I think it was used at, it had been used at 100, but it was certainly used up to 400 megahertz.
Mm-hmm.
I think mainly at the higher frequencies. And we'd the spectra, our paper on the spectra, must have been obtained using that area.
Now, what was your criteria for a source? How did something get into your catalog?
Well, it was obviously the fringes had to be well above the noise level on the record. It had to be repeatable at least twice, and the fringes had to last for a dozen or so fringes.
Were you concerned at all in terms of doing some calculations about what we now call confusion, to see whether this might be a problem?
No, I don't think we were really concerned. We were only concerned with the number of sources per beam area. Must have been very small.
Yeah.
We were only concerned with the 100 or so very strong sources over the whole sky. So I don't think confusion was really a problem.
Right. And...
Because we didn't know much about confusion problems anyway.
And can you remember about the distribution of these sources and what you made of that, having a map out of these 104 sources?
I'm afraid I can't remember anything specific about the distribution.
You had a remark here about a new concentration of faint sources in the southern galactic hemisphere. And I'm afraid I haven't checked the paper.
No, exactly. I can't remember the circumstances of that remark at all. I really can't answer that.
Okay, well, I can check that before I talk to John Bolton. Another question to ask is, what sort of contact did you have and awareness did you have of the work going on at Cambridge, which was along similar lines in many respects?
Well, I think we didn't have very much close contact with Cambridge. I think we only read the papers they published, and nobody had been over to England, I didn't think, from our group at that stage, and seeing what they were doing.
So you were operating pretty much independently, except for the published papers.
That's right.
Do you happen to remember how this survey agreed with the 1C survey, Ryle, Smith, and Elsmore?
No, I don't remember at all, really. I would suspect that they didn't agree too well at all. I remember the 1C survey was completely confusion-limited in many respects. They had, well, I suppose the stronger sources would have coincided. They would have had many, many more sources than we possibly detected on our system.
Well, hold it now. The 1C is 1950 with about 50 sources.
Is it?
The 2C is the one with
yes, that's right.
With the 2000.
That's the one of the
sources which came out
pointed on the North Cross.
Right, which came out in 55. Mm. So this was after your survey here. Okay, well, let's move on. What was the next thing you worked on once the Seacliff interferometer work was ended?
Well, I think towards the end of the sea interferometer work, the 80-foot dish was, which we dug in the ground in our lunch hours and so on, was coming into operation.
The hole in the ground?
Yes.
What do you mean you dug it in your lunch hours?
Oh, well, John Bolton and Gordon and I used to get out and wheelbarrows and dig out the sand during the lunch hour,
and then what were you doing during the normal day?
We were just working normally on our own equipment.
I see.
Surveying and analysis. But we used to do a lot of things in the lunch hours. We used to plant lawns and keep to hold the sand down. We used to put grass in and dig trenches. And
so it seems like it was more like an outdoor work hour than a lunch hour.
Yes. We did everything out there.
But at first it was not covered in concrete, it was just a hole, is that right?
It was just a hole, it's a mesh lay there, I think the original one, and then it was not long after that it was concreted.
And do you remember what where the idea for this dish came from? Was the one existing in Jodrell Bank at that time?
I think it was. Yes, that was where the idea must have originated. This had a long, pretty long focal length, and we were able to swing the beam 20 or 30 degrees from the zenith without too much distortion of the beam. And I think it was then that I think Gordon Stanley started off by using it for search for the deuterium line, 327 megahertz, with negative results.
That's right. Dick McGee is. Told me about that also.
And then we did a survey. I think at this stage John had more or less left for the cloud physics section, and Dick and I think perhaps Gordon was involved in the early stages, did a survey along the Milky Way with the dish at 400 megahertz.
That's right, that was 1955 that you published that. Mm. What were the main results of that survey?
Well, we discovered, I think the main result was we discovered the Sagittarius A source in the galactic center, plus several other non-thermal concentrations along the plane. I think the main result was Sagittarius A.
You say non-thermal. Did you have spectra for some of these discrete sources?
Well, no. I think it just turned out subsequently that they were non-thermal sources.
Okay, well.
At the time, we didn't have the spectra.
And the Sagittarius A result, of course, is quite interesting. Were you quite convinced that this was something to do with the galactic center, or what did you make of this?
Well, we weren't convinced, but I think we were fairly certain it was associated with the galactic center source. I think at the time, the Andromeda Nebula and so on, surveyed a jodel bank.
Right.
A nucleus been found in that source.
Oh, well, I'm not sure about that, no. I think it was just a distributed, definitely an extended source that more or less agreed with the optical image. But I don't think there was any nuclear concentration. I may be wrong on that. Well, this brings up another related question is, during this time, you must have been getting quite a self-education, so to speak, in astronomy. Learning about our galaxy and...
Yes.
Was this just from reading journal articles, or how did you go about doing this?
Mainly through just reading. We had no formal courses in astronomy, so I didn't attend any anyway. I don't think John did either.
There were no informal lectures within the radio physics, where one person would study one thing and talk about it to the others, or anything like this?
Not that I can remember, no. I think everybody did their own thing and just read up and did the best they could.
Hmm. Were there ever any literature, journal club type things in the radio physics lab where for the review of current literature?
No, we had colloquia from time to time, which people presented on their own results. But, I don't think there was any organized attempt to review the literature and give a seminar on. I rarely went into the laboratory actually in those days. I must have been at the laboratory only once or twice a year. I used to.
Oh, really? That infrequently?
Yeah, I lived out of Bondi close by and swim straight up to the sun. Home again. Perhaps a swim in Bondi on the way home during that. In the summer?
I guess that was true for a lot of people that spent very little time at the lab itself.
Yes, that's right. It's true.
Which, once again, led to these small groups really
yes,
being important units as opposed
important
to...
important in keeping these groups together as an entity.
How did Pawsey control?
Oh, it's by going around very frequently and keeping his finger on the pulse. I think he was really the cohesive force in the world at that time.
In what sense do you mean that? Well, he was head of the radio astronomy side.
Yes.
Right.
Well, he kept an overall view of the research going and suggested new lines, I think, of research.
And was he free to and often assigning people from one group to another, or was it mainly just through strong suggestions that these changes took place?
I think he was very forceful in changing people around. He tended to keep them together. No, there's very little for those, 5 or 6 years there, from 47 to 53, so there's very little interchange between the groups.
Mm-hmm. And did it change somewhat after 53? Same was there more?
Yeah, well, as soon as the Miller's Cross came on, Potts Hill, the hydrogen line worker, Potts Hill, solar work there. There was quite a bit of changing went on there. For instance, I left Dover Heights about 55 or so. I went to Flers to work with Bernie Mills and Mills Cross. And Kevin Sheridan came into the group too about that time.
Mm-hmm.
Mills Cross group.
Okay, another question that comes to mind is John Bolton, up till this time, of course, had a number of successes, to say the least, in this radio astronomy. Why did he switch to rain physics?
Well, because the chief of the division was a devoted cloud physicist, and I think he made it attractive for John to leave radio astronomy and go into cloud physics. And the group sort of stirred up a bit, cloud physics group, and he offered John, I think, some good inducements to go over there, to spend at least 2 or 3 years with the cloud physics group, which he did. And then he directly after he left for the United States, California.
Right. Okay. What else was there with this 80-foot hole in the ground? Was this what you did the occultation of Taurus A with?
No, I didn't.
What did you use for that?
That was out of Tefleur's.
Oh, I'm sorry, yes, east-west arm of the Mills Cross. Mm-hmm. I have it right here.
It didn't serve any occultation at all in Tefleur's.
And what were the main results of, you did this several years, I think.
Yes, well, we just deduced the variation of the scattered radiation as a function of separation from this angular separation from the sun in several years, and then interpret that in terms of radial electron densities in the corona of the sun. That was the main object of that work.
And I suppose you are aware of the similar efforts that were going on at Cambridge and I think elsewhere also at that time.
I think mainly at Cambridge and Russia and the Soviet Union, I think, started about the same time. Mitkovich.
That's right. He was the first one to suggest it, I think, perhaps.
Well, he claims he was, I think. I don't know if he did or not. But I think the Cambridge people started a couple of months before I did on that. In fact, it was to, I wasn't too sure of some of their results, so I decided to check it with the East Coast Arm of the Mills Cross.
Well, that would give you a fan beam.
Yeah.
I noticed that the abstract here says you had a pencil beam. And how was that achieved, also?
Oh, well, the Mills Cross itself is a pencil beam.
You had the entire Mills Cross.
Yes.
And the interferometer, what was that?
There were a couple of helical aerials out in the peg, which we could combine with the north-south arm of the cross as a switched Dickey system.
And what would be the advantage of, for instance, having this fan beam instead of the pencil beam?
Well, you had the fan beam is narrower than the pencil beam. As soon as you combine two aerials together in a Mills Cross system, the power response is proportional to the voltage response of each aerial.
Oh, that's right.
So if you can use an aerial fan beam total power mode, you get appreciably better resolution.
I must admit that point's never hit me before, that you get better.
Yes.
Yes, I see it now, all right. Okay. Now, there's another little article here about Hydra A being monitored for 12 months. And
you know, I started that work out of Dover Heights, actually, before I left the sea world.
Working with which dish?
The interferometer on the cliff, 100 megahertz, the one we used for the source survey.
And did you use other antennas also for the monitoring?
No, I only used the one monitored for a year or so. See if we find apparent intensity variations. And I continued that work out at Blur's, on the Mills Cross, using the east-west arm.
So was this a purposeful monitoring program? Mm. And was there any theoretical impetus or any reason why you were looking for it, or just because, why not?
Well, I started on the Mills Cross east-west arm observations were started in order to look for transient radio sources. And of course, I saw the east-west arm, you see the whole 24 hours each day coming through the fan beam.
Mm-hmm.
And keep a check on the daily intensities. And again, Hydra seemed to be variable. That's when I published that paper as a result of those observations.
That was, what you say, more variable than that of other sources.
Yes.
So you were checking them all relative
of course,
to each other.
That's again, at the Dover Heights with Taurus. There you go, and the other sources is controlling.
And this is at, what, 80 megahertz or so?
This was at 80 at Mills Cross and 100 megahertz at Dover Heights.
Now, I think it turns out that Hydra is not that variable, is that correct?
Well...
Or maybe it was then, or...
Apparently not.
What do you think was happening?
I suppose it's possibly ionospheric. It just happens that the Hydra here is, you view it along the magnetic field lines. I think that's maybe...
The Earth's magnetic field.
Yes, the field aligned regularity is maybe causing focusing effects and very reflection of this, which possibly gave us a confusing picture at the low frequencies.
Is it somewhat smaller in angular extent also, so that it might be more subject?
Yes, it's only a minute of arc at the most, an angular size. So it's rather smaller than the other strong sources around the, mm-hmm. the sky.
But nevertheless, that's quite interesting, because of course source variability in the 60s turned out to be a very important subfield.
It just happened to be the wrong wavelengths to detect it, that's
right. Right. Well, even yet later in the 70s, now we do have low frequencies, but not with the sort of sensitivity that you had then.
But I use these records again to persevere with atmospheric work on sources and correlations with geomagnetic activity and so on. This is the data from the east-west arm of the Mills Cross.
I see. And did you publish that in the late 50s?
Yes, it was published somewhere, I think.
I don't think I have that reference.
Probably published.
It may not have made the radio astronomy bibliography if it was pure ionosphere.
Ionosphere, right.
Australian Journal of Physics, 1962. Okay.
They also looked at one of the first people to look at satellite scintillation.
Yes, I was just noticing that paper. Which satellite was 1958 Alpha?
That was the first American satellite.
So that was, what was the name of it? Vanguard?
Something like that.
No. What was the name of it? Not Explorer. I think it was Vanguard. I think it was Van. Was it there?
I can't remember the name.
Well, anyway, it was the first little small.
Yeah, very small.
Small one. And you looked at its scintillations and found also an approximately 7-second modulation, according to the abstract. What was that?
That must have been the Faraday rotation effect, I think. I didn't know that I interpreted it at the time.
Why do you get this periodicity?
Yeah, because of the rotation of the satellite. It was a linearly polarized radio aerial.
Right.
And it was I'm not sure if it was due to the satellite rotation or whether it was a Faraday rotation effect, because our aerials were linearly polarized on the ground.
So I see.
I'm not sure which effect it is now. I've forgotten the details.
Were you using just a rigged up interferometer for looking at this satellite?
Yes, I had a special 2-dipole. I think interferometer on the ground.
Well, let's see now. Also, I just noticed that you and Bolton gave this Hydra A variation paper at the Jodrell Bank 1955 symposium. Did you yourself go to that?
No, John was there.
When, just out of interest, when was the first time that you went to a meeting outside of Australia?
I went to England in 1964.
Oh, I see.
I had the ERC here in 1950.
52. Mm. Did you go to that?
Mm.
Do you have any recollections of the radio astronomy activities in that?
Oh, no, of course. I remember meeting all the people from overseas, Cambridge and so on. Well, nothing particularly strikes me. Well, of course, at that time, talk about the end of the search work which was going on, the initial measurements in Cambridge and Bernie Mills was making the sizes of the sources. It was, I think, one of the highlights of the meeting.
And the Cygnus A identification just taking place.
Mm-hmm. But other than that, anything strikes me to be pretty important.
Was there during this period, relative to Cambridge, always sort of a sense of competition, would you say, or
there was a subdued sense of competition, I think. I don't think it was very rampant, not as far as I remember.
No, well, I'm just asking from your point of view. Mm. Yeah.
Other people claimed that it's that up the water.
Okay, you had a paper with Westfold, Bolton, and Stanley in 54 in which you talked about large radio sources, greater than a degree in size.
Yes.
One of these being, of course, Centaurus A. What in the world did you make of such a large source connected with a few arc minute sized galaxy? And were you really sure that...
Well, I don't think we came to any conclusions in the paper about that, did we? The possible mechanisms of
no,
radio emission?
No, I'm trying to get a feel for what you thought of it, though. I mean, were you thinking that it was an explosion or something out of which the galaxy condensed, or do you have any ideas along those lines?
Well, I think the explosion idea was probably the main the ejection of gas and so on from the galaxy was probably the main feeling we had perhaps for it.
Of course, this was colliding galaxy days,
yeah.
So this explosion would have been triggered by the collision of the galaxies.
That would have been the main feeling I think that I would have had at that time.
All right, the next thing is the Mills and Slee paper in 57, the first installment of the large survey. And perhaps if you could tell me about how you got involved with Bernie Mills and his cross and the survey and what the goals of the whole project were.
Well, I'd been responsible for taking much of the data to ensuring the operation of the cross, getting the data at headquarters, and Bernie decided that it would be a good idea to do a preliminary assessment of the records and get some feel before we started the main analysis. And we used just records we'd taken in the early sort of testing phase of the cross.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't at that stage have the beam switching system working. We just had single beam kind of data to work on. And we went quickly through the records and measured the intensities.
You had the 2C survey?
Yes.
Also?
Yes. And of course we measured the intensities and positions of the sources we could see on these records. Did the statistics of the log M, log S curves. And
now once again, let me ask you, what did you define as a source?
Well, an obvious bump on the record, which appeared to fit the size of the beam, occurred on at least two successive overlapping runs of the declination runs of the sky. We would shift the beam slightly each night, and we would overlap slightly.
Mm-hmm.
So that, it would have to be discrete and stand out above the noise level.
It could be larger than the beam, could it not, if it were extended?
Well, the same order. It could be larger, of course, but we certainly weren't restricted to point sources.
Mm-hmm.
It had to be an obvious bump, which was consistent with having passed through the aerial beam.
And
two or three times the aerial beam would be about the maximum kind of source size that you consider, I think.
And if it were larger than that, you would take it as a receiver?
Irregularity. Bernie talks a lot about background irregularities. The galaxy, the galactic structure.
As opposed to discrete sources,
yes.
I see. So those would not get cataloged?
No, well, if they were, we'd make a note usually.
Mm-hmm. Now, here you were more concerned about confusion problems, I think, is that fair to say? And, did you work at all on that sort of analysis, or was that mainly Bernie Mills? That...
Well, it was mainly Bernie Mills' work on that confusion analysis, what we expected, confusion effects we expected. I was concerned mainly with getting the results at that stage and doing the record and actual record analysis. I didn't do much interpretive work there.
I see. So, is it fair to say that the tone of the paper, which is very much not so much to present your results as to say that the Cambridge ones are all wrong, was mainly Bernie's doing? Although, did you concur in all this? Or would you have done it differently?
No, I think I would have concurred all right. I mean, I went through the analysis and checked it after Bernie produced his figures. And I think I agreed quite wholeheartedly with the tone of the paper.
Was there any... here it is. What do I want to say? What was your feeling about the work that the Cambridge Group was doing at that time? Did you feel that they did not understand how to analyze this data, or that they were... I mean, how did you feel that they had gone wrong, and why?
Well, we... we thought that the interpretation of interferometer records was far too enthusiastic. I mean, we felt they ignored the problems inherent in many sources in the interferometer, primary being errors, and hadn't worked out correctly their confusion effects. This is our main conclusion, I think.
Right, which the Mills Cross technique was not susceptible to
such. We had our own problems with side loads, of course, but we felt we'd considered them adequately. Strong sources in side load, and we thought we knew where all the side loads of significance were occurring, and we'd ignore those sources.
It would be interesting for me to know how much analysis did it take. Let's say for one day's strip chart records, did it take an hour to go through it? What was sort of the ratio of time?
Eric Hill and I did the main analysis of the records. Here's a typical record here. This is when we had the full beam switching technique going. This is a source coming through here, and we used to switch between four, maybe in positions I've forgotten, four, I think, that's right, and then come back to the original.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to do tracing. We all had to trace all these, each beam separately first, and then displace the tracings vertically.
I see.
And it's from the tracings that we worked.
So you had a girl or two assisting you in this?
Yes, we had one girl drawing tracings continually. And then Eric and I would come along and look at the tracings and measure up the sources, positions and intensities, decide which were real sources and which were side lobes.
Now, was much of this done unattended?
Yes, most of this was done unattended. Not the night the recording was done, totally unattended. We left at 4 o'clock. That's 13 degrees.
And would this be an example of
this extended source? I think.
Something would this get catalogued? This extended thing here?
I think it probably would be. Yes, except it wasn't a side lobe of the Centaurus A. This is their 1330. I think that would have been a genuine extended source. Here's the side of the idea.
Where's gone negative?
Uh-huh. That's probably Centaurus A. This is 13 hours, 1320. Maybe Centaurus A side load. Long meridian.
Right. How far away do these side lobes from strong source like Centaurus?
You could almost 30 or 40 degrees away.
Wow.
Because you're east-west, had a very wide mean north-south.
Mm-hmm.
Something like 40 degrees type power.
Right.
So whenever a strong source transited, you would expect either a positive or negative side wave to come through.
You said that Bernie Mills did most of the analysis. Nevertheless, let me ask you about whether you have any comment on one statement in here that
in the conclusions that an analysis of our results shows that there is no clear evidence for any effect of cosmological importance.